So
I'm sure we've gone off topic.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I don't mind. It's built to do that. We're cool.
Because I keep an eye on the original art stuff. I don't have a budget for original art, but one of my mates is a big dealer. He's a rep for Brian Bolland, Dave Gibbons and stuff. So I've ended up with like an eye on that industry, despite the fact that I haven't got the money for it. And that's another bunch of fucking lunatics.
I was just having this conversation with Derek last night, because Derek does collect original artwork, and the prices have just gotten insane. And so I would get commissions. He will actually buy original art pages and commissions, and like the numbers are just insane right now. And so we were having a whole conversation about that.
Yeah, I mean there's a lot of Bitcoin type money coming into it, and a lot of stuff's disappearing into strange holes in the Far East and Russia, and there's a lot of investment in comic art, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know. I don't know. That's a Mark Badger Batman Shadow commission that I got him to do.
Cool.
Like $75. He sent me all the prelims. He sent me the pencils for the final piece. A couple of sketchbooks and some studies from Still Life. I mean, just a ridiculously pleasant experience. If you like Mark Badger, I recommend trying to get something from him, because it won't be as unpleasant as maybe some of the experiences you've had. But I've got on an aliens front, I've got a James Stokoe alien. I've got a page from that Aliens mini he did.
Oh, Dead Orbit, right?
Yeah, they're pretty cheap. It's just ridiculous.
He's in that weird zone where he's obviously been published in the mainstream, but he's still, I think thought of as sort of an indie guy. And the indie guys aren't as valued as the quote unquote mainstream artists. But that was a miniseries that was so interesting to me. Most of the alien stuff I own were the omnibuses, because I would say, I'm okay. But that's one of the trades where I actually owned the trade paperback before the project even got started, because it just looked too interesting to me. That art style applied to aliens, and seeing a creator, a writer artist with an indie background, I wanted to read that, and I'm still looking forward to reading it. It's just that now that I'm doing the podcast, it's like, okay, well, you get to wait for another few years.
Chronological release date order, whatever.
We'll see. You know, if I ever burn out on it, then I can always like, well, here's a special. You know, we'll do end count to it. But I know at some point I'm going to read it, because if I had the interest to buy it as a trade, I definitely want to read it and probably talk about it afterwards.
Has it got like the back matter that the deluxe version has in? Like he basically did about 10 pages or so before.
I'll pull off the shelf. Give me a sec. Okay, you were saying?
Has it got a load of these? Has it got like a really good extra section in it?
It looks like it's got a sketchbook section. Hold on a second. It's substantial. So okay, there goes the ending.
Yeah, because certainly in the deluxe version you get about I can't remember. I want to say about 10. Maybe it's less than that. But there's a good few pages. His original approach to it was a bit more aliens than alien.
Yeah.
So the final thing is very alien.
The one I've got is the soft cover collection. I don't know if there's, I guess you're probably, sounds like you're talking about a hardcover. So this one's got what looks to be maybe some variant covers or the individual issue covers.
Mm.
Then it's got clearly some variant covers, because I'm seeing Jeff Darrow, Raphael Albuquerque. And then, like you said, there's the preview pages that have more of a manga vibe to them.
Yeah. Okay. So it has got, I thought it probably would have all the stuff on the deluxe, but that's, it's really interesting, because it's like,
it's a good plus pages or stuff. Yeah, very frenetic. You're right. Yeah.
But that was basically his original approach, and then he scrapped it and went for what he did in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it really interesting that you get like 10 pages of aliens type stuff
right
back of it. After having read your alien, it's like a very heavily alien inspired mini series. I love it, but
Excellent.
But I'm rambling. Do you want to talk some aliens?
Sure. So we did some biographical stuff. That's probably not going to be part of the aliens show. I'll probably say that for something down the line.
Sure.
Hell, some of that art stuff might find its way into something random too, since it goes with the conversation I had last night. And also, one thing too is beyond the actual core Daredevil run, there's a graphic novel called Love and War that Miller did with Bill Sienkiewicz. I would definitely recommend checking that one out, because that one was very involved with the Kingpin and his relationship with Vanessa.
Okay.
And so while there were other stories around that time period that dealt with similar subject matter, if you're wanting to find like a nice little ground zero starting point to get into Kingpin story specifically,
yeah,
that would be a good place to go.
Okay.
And like I said, that was a Marvel graphic novel. I don't know if they ever reprinted it in it, because the graphic novels were like big, like magazine sized books.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know if it's on Marvel Unlimited, and I don't know if they ever reprinted it in a standard comic book size. Okay. I read it as the big graphic novel though.
Oh, okay.
And it's, I think it's like 48 pages or 64 pages.
Okay.
And it's all painted artwork.
Uh-huh.
So it's a beautiful book.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah.
That makes sense, because that's what I did with, that's how I read the Batman Black Mirror
mm-hmm.
part.
Because you went backwards after you found you liked Scott Snyder.
Yeah, I like Scott Snyder. I was like, what else is he writing? I said Black Mirror for Batman, and Dick Grayson as Batman after the battle for the cow or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I liked the way he treated Dick Grayson. You know, he didn't act like Bruce Wayne.
He allowed him to be a man without being the same man.
Right, exactly. And I really appreciated that. I mean, there was this one small sequence where Jim Gordon's talking to Batman on the roof next to the bat signal, and Jim Gordon turns around and he's like, oh, you're still there. And Dick Grayson's Batman is all like, why wouldn't I be? He goes, well, I'm just used to you just disappearing at this point. And so there's kind of like an awkward, hey, you're still here.
Yeah.
And you know, and I like that subtlety, that mm-hmm. little difference there. And so that was really cool. And so things like that really catch my attention. You know, mm-hmm. if it's just flat, boring dialogue or anything like that, and it has to be interesting. And if it's not interesting, I won't follow it.
And I'll be honest too. When I was coming up reading comics in the 80s, there were a lot of journeyman writers, mm-hmm. guys that were just okay. And it was much easier to follow the characters, not only because you know a Batman comic from another Batman comic. A Batman comic isn't a Spider-Man comic. You know, you can just look and see this guy's in blue and gray, this guy's in red and blue. They're not the same guy.
Uh-huh.
But then you have that progression. First, you have the icon. You can see just by colors that this guy's different from this guy. And then you regress to the artists. This guy is, I like how this guy draws Iron Fist. John Byrne draws Iron Fist really good, where Dennis Cowan isn't as exciting to me. And so I'll want to buy the John Byrne version, not the Dennis Cowan version, for instance. And then you kind of progress from there, and then you get to writers. But also, just a lot of comic book writing was mediocre. You know, when I was coming up, you bought them for the art and for the characters, and writing over the years have gotten stronger and stronger. And we've gotten better writers in part because the artists can go to other mediums, the writers can go to other mediums, but you never have the same creative freedom as a writer in any other medium beyond prose fiction. If you try to be a screenwriter or you try to work in film, anything like that, there's all these people who are going to tell you how to change your story, and you're always going to be beholden to them. Where as long as you're not on a major book, or at least it used to be this way, you would just go off and write your stories, and a few months later they're drawn and they're on the newsstand. And that's extremely satisfying, that the story that you wanted to tell got out there, and the element of collaboration was that you wrote the story and somebody else drew it, and you get to marvel at the artistry that they brought to your story. So we've just gotten stronger and stronger writers, where artists, because of how long it takes to produce a comic book, the quality and the variety of comic art has changed, but you get a lot less comics out of an individual artist, and that individual artist can make a lot more money doing design work for films or producing commissions that he sells directly to the patron, stuff like that. So the comic books themselves almost become like this drudgery you have to do to get your name out there so that you can do the other stuff you want to do.
Okay.
So you're usually safer following a writer because they tend to write more books in a given month than an artist could possibly produce.
Right.
They tend to stay on the books longer. And because they have unparalleled freedom for a commercial medium, you know, it's one of the best places to be a writer, you know, for page rate.
Okay.
So writing has just gotten a lot better in recent years. They're just this is across the board too, because television writing has gotten phenomenal as well.
Right.
Because people are realizing that there's not the money that it takes to produce one movie and all the complications that comes with producing one movie. If you can get a series going and you've got a whole team of writers working on that, and they're all can do the best work they can, and they're telling a longer story that's more novelistic, they can just do better work in television.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just the mediascape has changed, and now that's why the writer is king in so many media, because they've become the primary storytellers,
mm-hmm.
and they found the
mediums in which they can tell the best stories they're capable of.
Ah, okay. Wow. That's cool. And it all came from, being kind of missing the boat on things. You know, mm-hmm. I missed the boat on a lot of things by the time I came back into comic books. Mm-hmm. And so I just really didn't have a concept of, you know, where was Daredevil? How come I missed him, you know, with this kind of interesting three-dimensional story arcs? Mm-hmm. How did I miss him? And so missing that really just threw me for a loop. And it's like, I'm not used to missing stuff that seems important.
Yeah. It's just, you couldn't call Daredevil a cult book, but you could definitely say that it flew under the radar in terms of like the Twitterati weren't talking about Daredevil.
Yeah.
You know, the Wizard magazine wasn't necessarily pimping Daredevil. It wasn't necessarily on people's lips, but it apparently was on a lot of people's pull lists long enough to where they, you know, I mean, the last volume of Daredevil ran over 100 issues, and that doesn't happen very much anymore.
No, it doesn't. And like, I remember back in the 90s was Punisher, Punisher War Journal, Punisher this, Punisher that. Everybody was talking about Punisher at that time, but nobody was talking about Daredevil.
Not
in my circle.
No, what I'm saying though is at that point in time when Punisher was ascendant, Daredevil was not really as well regarded. Because I said, you know, one of my favorite Daredevil stories was by D.G. Chichester, but there's also a lot of stuff, especially after that arc, where the art really wasn't up to par, where the guy seemed to have kind of run out of stories and was facing more editorial interference besides, where they put him in the stupid armor with all the gimmick covers. So that wasn't a good time to be reading Daredevil. And then even after he left, he was replaced by Carl Kiesel, who was trying to tell a different kind of Daredevil story than people wanted at that point in time. So that didn't go very well. Mm-hmm. And then he was replaced very calculatedly by Joe Kelly and the return of Gene Colan. But Gene Colan in 1996 was not the Gene Colan of 1966. So it just felt like anachronistic, and it just didn't have the pop to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the book just slowly wound down to a close, but it showed that there was enough of a fan base to support that book for nearly 100 issues, even when it wasn't very good, or where it wasn't in tune with the wants of the times at the very least.
Right.
So at that time, Daredevil just probably wasn't that good, and that's why people were buying Punisher books instead.
Oh, okay.
Plus, Punisher was doing some great stuff at that point in time, because you had Mike Barron and a variety of quality artists on the main Punisher book. Then you had Chuck Dixon on Warzone. You had Carl Potts and Jim Lee doing War Journal when it was first getting started. Chuck Dixon wrote a lot of Punisher work in the 90s, and Chuck Dixon became one of the highest profile and most Batman writers in the late 90s, and you know, really the late 90s. So that was an instance where it really was a writer-driven book, because the Punisher character was popular, but the stories that were written by Chuck Dixon tended to be more popular than most.
Okay.
So that was like an early example of an artist-driven book a writer-driven book to a large degree. Wow. Because a lot of people they not only wanted to read a Punisher story, but they specifically wanted to read a Chuck Dixon Punisher story. And again, when Punisher got popular again in the late 90s, early 2000s, is because Garth Ennis of Preacher fame, along with his artist Steve Dillon, were doing the Punisher. But Steve Dillon left, and people were still wanting to buy the Punisher of Garth Ennis.
Right.
So Punisher's another character that, while having a strong visual, usually what sells that book is the writer.
Okay. All right, man. So I feel a lot better now about the writers that I follow, like Scott Snyder and stuff. Well,
Scott Snyder's doing some of the best regarded stuff right now.
So, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
You know, and that's one of the great success stories of the New 52, was they really figured out how to do Batman in a way that a broader audience was wanting to return to. And it's not like Batman was ever unpopular, but it seems like the character felt like he was sort of winding down at the point where Scott Snyder came in. Like, Grant Morrison had told all the stories he really needed to tell and was maybe getting a little indulgent by that point.
Oh, okay.
And Snyder and Capullo just showed, no, this is how you do a Batman book. And it sold many times what the Batman book had been selling prior to their arrival.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
Okay, well, it was funny, too. Somebody was saying, I don't know, Greg Capullo, that's a Spawn guy. I don't know if he's going to work on Batman. It's like, I can hardly think of an artist that would be better on Batman than Capullo. And now he's one of the greats as far as Batman fans are concerned.
He does a good Batman. He does a good Batman. I mean, whether you like Batman or not, he's got a good artist.
Well, and I like, too, that he looks like a man. I got so tired of him looking like he's some sort of a demon or some sort of like crazy serial killer type character. It's like, one of the things that's great with Capullo, he looks like a hero again. He looks like a grown-ass man and a hero again.
Right. Okay, cool. Yeah, that's really awesome. That's all I got.
Okay. Well, yeah, I know. It was going to be a warm-up, but it kind of ended up going a little further out than I planned. But I think I could I'm going to chop that up and put it in a bunch of different places, I think.
That's fine.
I mean, if you want to get into cards, right, like I think the things that I can most point to is, like, you know, I think you were jonesing for, you know, the Marvel Universe trading cards. Like, those were a big deal, like, to me, that DC and DC Cosmic cards, like, those two sets were, like, a big deal for me. Death of Superman, they had the whole card set, like, that was a big deal for me. But I think I want to say, like, oh, okay, and I take it back, the maybe the Star Wars Galaxy cards too, like from Tops or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was like I think that was a big deal because of all the caliber of artists they had.
Yeah, doing, like, even I have some of those cards, and I was kind of out of Star Wars by, like, then, like, those cards, like, are nice,
you know. But I mean, I think I want to say, like, after, you know, after it got to, like, you know, the painted cards, like the Jusco cards, and the, you know, I think basically as the price of buying an entire set of boxed cards increased, and I felt like, you know, oh, well, I have Marvel Series 1, I have Marvel Series 2, I have this entire Death of Superman thing, and then me being butthurt that even when you bought, like, a whole box set of cards, you didn't get all the holograms, and it's like, you know, I think after doing that for 4 or 5 times, I think I might be missing a few card sets in there here or there, but I think, you know, after a while, I probably, you know, gave up on that. Like, but the off the top of my head, you know, the first two Marvel ones, the first two DC ones, and then the Death of Superman, and then those Galaxy cards. Oh, you know what I still have a complete thing of, which I forgot about, is they made a Unity card set, and I think I have all of that still in, like, a little, I don't know, plastic card case somewhere. Mm. But yeah, other than that, I can't. I mean, and definitely Dark Horse stuff, I don't think I, you know, if they made card sets of Comics Greatest World, I don't have that. Or, you know, if they did it of Terminator or any of the other licensed franchises, like, I don't think I have any of that.
Luckily, that was in around the time that I might have burnt out like you had. I was getting into retail and getting, like, cost plus 10 or whatever on my boxes. So I pretty much went through the rest of the decade at the minimum buying all the DC sets. I even bought the stupid ones with the embossed cards where the entire set was embossed. I had the Chromium Power cards, and then I even got into Overpower, the collectible card games. So pretty much right up until the turn of the century, I was still buying card sets, and I got into Star Wars collectible card games, so I'll have a whole box or two of those things.
I feel like those and all these random things are the bane of my existence now, because now everybody comes to me on Comic Art Fans, they're like, we don't know what this is from, you always know where everything's published, and usually I can find shit sometimes, but now people come up with this weird ass trading card bullshit and this fucking shit I've never seen, and half the time I have to tell them, look, man, I don't know where this shit is from because I've never seen it before. And sometimes I can find that stuff and sometimes I can't. And if I can't, I just tell them, look, I can't find it. So I can't, you know, prove to you that it's published. But that's why this is total tangent sidebar. You can cut all this shit out. But that's why I bought that that DC Year of Change 1993, because I bought that one, whatever it is, like pinup of, you know, with the
I don't know the guy, the artist, the guy who looks like
Bill Lux or whatever, because I bought that, and then I bought the you know, that, you know, faux previews thing or whatever. But speaking of rando things that I feel like acquiring, like, I kind of want to, I mean, they're expensive, but I kind of want to get the rest of those, because I had fun just flipping through that, whether I own the art from it or not.
And the sad thing is, I'd love to give you one, I've got a spare, but I think it's the same one you already bought. I think I also have a spare of 93.
That's fine.
But if I have any other year, I'll happily give it to you. But I collect those. I love those. Those are like what ifs, because there's so much shit, especially in that time period where there was so much stuff being produced that never got released. Never did anything.
You know, throwing me to the wolves with the Nightwing shit. I noticed in the whatever it was, like the 92 book or whatever, mm-hmm. the one the year before that. Like, there's actually like a Art to Bear like Nightwing image. You know, from like the original solo book they were gonna do. They never fucking did. So I was like, oh, that's cool.
Remind me, was that the one that has him and Starfire together?
Yeah, it's like Starfire looked like a fucking Shi'ar or some shit. I don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, she looked weird. Like, I assume it's Starfire, but yeah.
Yeah, they originally had that in an Amazing Heroes that I bought, one of the last issues that came out, and I was like, oh my god, this is gonna be so cool! I can't wait for this miniseries to come out. Yeah. And then, of course, he eventually does the poster in, I think, Titan Sellout.
Yeah.
Where it's like a full holdout poster, and of course it never ends up happening. So I was like, wow, I just teased this.
I wasn't going to lie to anybody. I was all Jones for that too.
Yeah. But I think
in hindsight though, that was all of that was a big fucking mistake. But yeah.
Well, actually, the thing of it is, if that miniseries had come out with that art T-Bear artwork and him teaming up with Corey and shit, it probably would have changed the course of Nightwing's history, because I think it would have been a success, and I think you would have had a more Titans flavored series. Even if he was solo, he would have probably had closer ties to the Titans. And instead, because that never came out, the miniseries is as completely into the Batman family, nothing to do with the Titans.
Yeah.
So it really does alter the course of the character's history that that book never comes out, and he does black and white instead.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay.
Killian Plunkett. I like Killian Plunkett an awful lot.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, on your Martian Manhunter thing, I must send you, Sean Phillips is another mate of mine,
mm-hmm.
and he gave me all the pencils and inks to the story that Kent Williams, basically the Rick Leonardi, Kent Williams, JLA classified story, which is basically a Martian Manhunter story, you know what I mean?
I think so. Was that the one? Because I always remember the Walt Simonson covers.
His brother coming back.
Yeah, I always remember the Walt Simonson covers, and then I forget that the interiors are completely different. But also, Leonardi being inked in a way that was very un-Leonardi like was more palatable to me. So again, I'm sorry. I don't mean to keep taking shots at the guy, but I appreciated that if I was going to have Rick Leonardi do a Martian Manhunter story, that he's being inked in an uncharacteristic style, and I remember liking that story okay. I've always disliked the actual character that's at the center of that story. I don't care for Malefic, evil twin brothers. It's like, get the fuck out of here. But I thought they did a good job with things that I didn't want to see done, basically. And art-wise, I remember liking that, finding it more palatable than I'd normally find Leonardi.
Yeah, well, it was
was it Kent Williams that inked him, or was it Sean Phillips?
No, sorry.
But it was a Kent Williams look to it.
It was Sean Phillips inking it.
Yeah.
But he was inking it per the Rick Leonardi Kent Williams issue of Uncanny, which is like the one with Jubilee, where they're in the underground, they're under the outback, and she's trying to nurse Wolverine back to health after he's come down off the crucifix.
Yeah.
So it's that issue. Basically, Sean Phillips got to ink it, but he chose to go a bit mad with the inks, a la Kent Williams on those Uncannies. So Sean gave me the Leonardi pencils and the Kent Williams inks. I've got those for all five issues. They're unlettered, but the main thing for me, David Barron is a guy who started at Wildstorm, came alongside Laura Dupuy. I think they might have been married at some point or something, but he's fucking awful. I won't buy books because he's in them. I'll get rid of books because, given a choice out of 10, he does 5. I'll get rid of the 5 that he does the colours on, you know?
Wow.
But he coloured that story. And it was a middling story anyway. But nonetheless, I've got the pencils and the inks, and I've passed them your way in your Martian Manhunter.
And that was Justin Gray's, I recall, too, on the writing. I think it was Gray on his own, wasn't it? Right, or was it Gray and Palmiotti?
I think it was just Justin Gray.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. And I liked it fine. And it, I do appreciate that. I'm glad that Sean Phillips was there to do the inks. But yeah, you're right. He was. That when you said when you referenced Kent Williams, it did kind of look like that, didn't it? But I don't have a strong enough memory of the story to go into much detail with it. But yeah, I do remember enjoying as much as it would be possible for me to enjoy Leonardi drawing it because of the inks, I think. But I don't remember the coloring at all. You went to the movies, I understand.
Yeah, we went to a studio movie grill to grab lunch and see Raya the Last Dragon.
Okay.
We took the kids. It was their first movie-going experience, and it was just fine. I'd never at any point felt threatened by a virus or anything. It was good.
Cool. You guys were masked up, I assume?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, while we were eating. You know, that's one of the dine-in theaters. So while you're eating, of course, you don't have your mask on. But
yeah.
But those places inherently have large gaps from row to row. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To make room for, the tables and stuff like that. So, it was good. It was good. There was, nobody there.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some people in our theater for sure, but it was a little depressing that it was just like, man, this huge facility, and there's flat screen TVs and bars and food, and there's maybe 15 people in the whole building, and I'm like, ooh, this is brutal. Brutal. But yeah, we pretty much decided whenever Black Widow comes out, even though we've got Disney Plus, we're going to go see it in the theater. Mm-hmm. We're going to babysit it. We're getting the hell out of here. So
yeah, I think by then it'd be okay. With vaccinations and everything else, yeah, I don't see why you couldn't go. I mean, they might still want to have some separations of seating and such, but I don't think you'd need to like rent out a theater for that at that point, hopefully.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, you'd hope like what, 50% of the theater is probably vaccinated, mm-hmm. and then you yourself is vaccinated and the person who was vaccinated and you're masked up the whole time. Like,
and one would hope, probably not wisely, would hope that somebody who actively was having symptoms of some type would not go to right. a movie theater, but you know how that shit goes.
Yeah. So then you've got somebody who's asymptomatic, which is a small sliver of the population, plus the people in there are vaccinated, plus, you know, you're sitting in there with your mask on. I think you'll probably be fine.
My only real reservation, like actually going in and watching a movie would not be a problem for me. I might have reservations about eating or drinking during the movie, but I think that'll be fine.
Well, let me tell you this. We were surprised. The Studio Movie Grill or whatever it was, their margaritas are incredible. So if we go back there, we are definitely getting margaritas for sure. We were like blown away how good their margaritas were. I'm like, how have we only been here like one time when they first opened ever? Mm-hmm. We have to go back to this place.
Well, it's like when we went to see Wonder Woman, it wasn't catered, but it's not like that kind of arrangement. But because we'd rented the theater, you get certain liberties. So they set up a table at the front of the theater for them to put out food and stuff, presumably for a large group. But obviously that's not the way that worked out. But they made good food. You know, it was quite tasty. And I don't think I can have access to that being brought to the theater. But going up to their stand and having that made for us and taking it back into the theater might be worth doing, you know, as long as the comfort level was there.
I'm trying to remember what I got for food, but it was good. Mm-hmm. Whatever it was like surprisingly good. Yeah, man. The only thing is that it wasn't, well, I don't know if maybe they weren't showing that movie since it's just like a Disney movie or something in one of their big theaters. Mm-hmm. The sound wasn't quite where I'd want it to be. Whereas the, Mr. Fixit says his computer is currently updating. Okay, yeah. But the, what do you call it? The main theater, which is where I know Black Widow would be, mm-hmm. at the movie theater closest to us, is absolutely ridiculous. So I kind of would be like, maybe we'd pass with margaritas to go see Black Widow there. But just because the experience would be so much more than being at home, yeah. that it'd be kind of be like, it's a little tempting. Well, it's like a Disney movie. I don't really care.
I still, you know, I mean, I had other things to do this weekend, but I still haven't watched Kong versus Godzilla, in part because it feels like a movie that you would go to a movie theater to see. And so I'll probably break down rather than going into a theater, but I still kind of feel like that's a movie you'd want to see in a theater. So where a lot of people I know were watching it Wednesday when it dropped, you know, we're recording on Monday and I still haven't gotten around to it.
Yeah, I mean, at first I was sort of like excited to see it, but after it came out and I'm like, you know what, I am in no rush at all. Mm-hmm. But for sure, like, I know people who went and saw it in IMAX and they seem to like it. I bet that movie in IMAX is pretty rad, but I bet if you watch it at home on like a 50-inch TV, it's probably just like, oh, it's two kaiju smashing into each other, you know?
Right.
I'd be kind of curious to see what the level of excitement was for that movie after seeing it in the theater versus seeing it in your house. Mm-hmm. I bet that's a film that's very much affected by that.
Yeah, but the folks who did watch it at home have been seemed to be happy with it. And see, Paquita hadn't seen any of the Godzilla movies, so she decided to watch those. She'd already seen Kong Skull Island, so she just watched the Godzilla ones. And I got bits and pieces of it, and to me it just seemed like it was too dark, like visibly too dark too much of the time. I think sitting in a movie theater watching black ice for long periods of time would get kind of tedious. It's not great at home either. So I think that was contributory to some of the dampened enjoyment of Godzilla, you know, the current theatrical incarnation. And I think a lot of that money is coming from the Kong people, especially people that discovered Kong Skull Island after the fact, because I saw that one at home. I wasn't going to go see that in the fucking movie theater. I wasn't planning on seeing it, period. But when I did see it, I was surprised at how good it was. And I think part of it, though, is it was bright. You know, you've got the autumnal colors and you've got a lot of sunlight. You get a good look at the monsters. You've got the whole island, so they're interacting with their environment more. Where a lot of this shit with Godzilla, it seems like it's too much ice, too cold and too dark, and just, I don't know. It also, like, thematically too dark. I liked how, while there was, you know, intense emotions in amongst the players in Kong, the feeling of the movie itself was still fun. A macho kind of fun, but they were having a good time playing the 70s music. You got, you know, John C. Reilly running around being a goofus and shit like that.
Yep.
It felt more like, I don't want to say it felt like a Mummy movie, but it was
have that kind of tone where you might have darker moments, but the overall tone was light enough to where it didn't sink the movie in the way that I think Godzilla seemed to take itself way too seriously. Too much family drama, too, from what I saw.
Yeah, I told M'lady about watching Godzilla versus Kong, and she was all like, we haven't seen any of the movies. I was like, well, I mean, we haven't even seen Skull Island. And it's like on the list. It's in all my watch lists on every streaming service for us to eventually watch it. So I'm like, this is more of an excuse for us to watch Skull Island than it is to actually watch anything else. But I'm like, we could probably just watch Kong Skull Island and then watch Kong versus Godzilla, and that's probably all the background you need.
Well, right? You and I saw Godzilla. You know, I don't feel like having experienced that movie would in any way seriously enrich, you know, seeing Kong versus Godzilla.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you just have to understand what Godzilla is, and that's it, right? You probably don't even need to watch Kong Skull Island to understand what happens either, but at least since I've heard good things about that movie, it will at least give you some setup, right?
Well, not just that, but the fact is, you know, I don't care for giant monster movies. I don't like dinosaurs, shit like that. That's just a good fucking movie. You know, there's so many great performers in that movie, and it's a really good time. You know, I mean, it's Vietnam set, and it has that kind of that vibe to it. You know, you got a lot of CCR and shit. As a person who isn't really into that kind of shit, I'm surprised how much I enjoyed it. It was just really well done. I really want to see what that director is going to do next, too. I was just impressed with it overall.
I would like to watch. We watched Wolverine instead. So.
Yeah, sorry.
X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Yeah. So you still didn't get around to the other one, huh?
No.
Really wasn't time. Because I knew once you told me that you hadn't watched it over the weekend, and that shit's long. You know, it's like you're not coming home from work and then watching the Wolverine and then recording a podcast. That's not going to happen, especially on a work night, a weeknight. So, nah. So,
I mean, we could have watched it yesterday.
You don't really need to. I'm pretty sure Fix It will be involved with that, too. But don't even worry about it.
One problem is, it seems like it's the better movie. And I'm like, I would rather watch the better movie of the two.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Like, there's more to talk about with X-Men Origins. So, although, you know, we're not going to go nuts. This isn't going to be a podcast about any one of the movies. It's kind of an overview of the character. I want to do a more comic book discussion because so much of the shows has been about the movies and TV shows that we've kind of drifted away from the comics. And I think that's hurt because I think a lot of people who liked the show earlier on liked that we talked about the comic books where everybody talks about the movies now. But also the whole impetus of this is that I want to get all the Fox movies watched before the end of the year, before they're completely irrelevant and we start looking at other things.
10-4, man. Like I said, as much as I don't like any of these Fox movies, I do like the excuse to kind of watch them. I like to have an excuse to watch them because I've been very open on this podcast that I just have no, like, what was it, when Apocalypse came out? I'm like, you and Fixit can go see it. I have no interest in these films. Anyway, I have opinions, but I don't want to talk about it until Homeboy gets on.
Right, exactly. But one thing I do want to mention, too, is that there's probably, especially with the comic book stuff, there's probably going to be a lot of circumstances where you're just going to say, no, I don't know anything about that. I never read that. So don't feel like you got to actually say that out loud. And now if I specifically say Mac, yada, 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 then bust it there. But especially when I'm talking about comic book stuff, I'm mostly going to be like, Fix It. Do you remember that? And can you elaborate on that? You know, because there's no sense in belaboring it because I know it's not your bag. It's not like you can talk the movies, especially the one you watched, and you can talk the more general character stuff. But you didn't read a run of classic X-Men. You didn't read, you know, any of this shit. So just know that. I'll save it for the podcast then.
We're talking about Wolverine.
Just know that when you're, you know, if you're saying in the negatory, I don't know about that. I have nothing to say about that. Just don't say it. But if you do have something, I especially want you to jump in because the plan is to go kind of chronologically through the publication history and then ideally have like the spine is that, and I'll be sharing a lot of my own stuff specifically, but to have you guys jump in on the parts that are actually relevant to you and elaborate.
Gotcha.
I did enjoy the prequel Predator with the Indians, Prey. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I enjoyed that movie. It was good. I like that they did it in English and they did it in the Indian Native American tongue. That's pretty neat. I didn't watch the one. I have a hard time watching subtitle movies because you have to put all your attention to it. And if you're watching it at home, it's kind of hard to pay complete attention when there's other things going on around you. Unless I'm going to be sitting there watching the movie specifically with all the lights off and no distraction, I'd just rather just watch the English version, the dub version, or something like that.
You know, most of the cast is going to be in Dallas in May.
Are they? Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Amber Midthunder, Dakota Beavers, I think his name is, the brother, and the actual Predator. All three of them will be in town. Not in our town, but in
Dallas.
Slightly north of Dallas. Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with Irving, but Texas Frightmare Weekend in May.
I wonder if I'm off of this.
Yeah, because they got most of a good chunk of the original Halloween cast. So a lot of the cast of The Thing. So John Carpenter is coming So a lot of the people who were associated with him from those two movies are also coming. Yeah.
Is Keith David going to be there?
Yeah, Keith David is there. That's correct.
Nice.
No, Kurt Russell, unfortunately. That would definitely be.
Would be awesome.
Yeah. And then you also got both of the Raimi brothers as well.
The which brothers?
Raimi.
Which ones are those?
Sam Raimi and Ted Raimi.
Oh, the Raimi brothers. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Evil Dead. Love the Evil Dead movies. Yeah. I heard that Evil Dead Rise is actually really good. Rotten Tomatoes is even giving it good scores.
Oh, I'm seeing that one theatrically for sure.
Oh, yeah. Same here. I'm waiting for that
one. And I got friends that watch the trailer and are like, I ain't going to see that. Not because they don't want to. They're not going to the theater and being subjected to that. I'm going for it, though.
I mean, I liked the Fede Alvarez one.
I did, too.
The Jane Levy one. Mm-hmm. Oh, she did such a good job. I don't know why she's not in more stuff. Mm-hmm. She was good in Lights Out. I really like her acting ability. I watched her in that TV show she was on.
The one with the musical stuff?
Yes. That one was really good, too. I enjoy her acting. And ever since I saw her in that Evil Dead remake, the Fede Alvarez one, I was just like, she's good. I like her. She's okay in my list.
Yeah. It's like you said, though. She did that. She did the Don't Breathe. And then she kind of left genre. And just, I mean, she did a little bit on the Stephen King show, the Castle Rock. But I don't think they ever did anything substantial with her character, if I remember correctly. I only watched the first season, so.
Is it still going? I only watched the first few episodes of the first season. I didn't finish that one off.
I got partway through the second season now that I think about it. I think it just cost too much and it wasn't getting a big enough audience, so they canceled after the second season.
Yeah. For me, the biggest problem with most shows now is there's so many different platforms and people just can't afford them all.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes it difficult. I've been watching, The Orville.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You heard that? Yeah. The Seth MacFarlane. That's a good show. They did some really interesting stuff with that. I like, they tore from the headlines, but they did it in a way that wasn't like in your face. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, what I always hear is that it's the most Star Trek show that's on, despite all the spinoffs they've got going right now. That's the one that feels the most like an actual Star Trek show.
It absolutely does feel like a Star Trek show. But the interesting thing is that if you watch the first trailer of the show, they stepped on the Seth MacFarlane's a comedian, it's a joke, it's a Family Guy, you know, like they really pushed the comedy of the trailer, and I think that's what hurt it in the beginning, because the second you start watching, you're like, this is, you're waiting for the laugh. When I first started watching that show, I was waiting for the laughs, but I realized, I was like, oh, he's not making fun of Star Trek, he's reimagining Star Trek to more of a modern take, and like ripped from the headlines of modern take kind of thing. You know, things that are happening now are going to be relevant on the show. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so once you realize that the show is not as full of jokes as, it does have levity, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't have the same kind of levity that he has on, say, Family Guy or something like that, or even A Million Ways to Die in the West or whatever. It's got levity, but it's still a very serious, like, he's taking the show seriously, you know? And I think once you get past that idea, you really enjoy the show. Like I enjoy the show. There's some shows that I was just like blown away. There's some episodes where I was blown away. Not all of them, but some.
I've heard really good things. It's one of those where I heard that it kind of struggled that first season, and then finding the time to get through season one to get to the good season two or season three or whatever. It's like, but that's a whole season. So maybe one of these days I can try to jump in the middle of it or watch some highlights and get sucked in, basically.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you what it's like. It's like watching the first season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., mm-hmm. where they went into that show and they were like, well, we don't want it to be, you know, we just want it to be tangent to the Marvel Universe, and we have to base it on what's happening in the Marvel Universe, and so we need to make sure that the storyline coincides and all that stuff. They were trying to connect it without connecting it, in the sense that they don't want to have superheroes or whatever, like major superheroes on it. And then once they decided, you know, once that Civil War turn came out, it really pushed the show in a very good direction, made it worth watching, you know. The same kind of thing, not the same type of event, but the same kind of thing happens with Orville. It's going kind of like, okay, this just feels a very episodic, like a regular Star Trek original series type stuff, or I would say more Next Generation type stuff, more Next Generation type thing. And then it kind of hits its stride, like near the end of the season. And that's when you're just like, oh, okay, all right, now I'm in, I am invested. And it's just like you're saying, but I think it has that same kind of feel from the beginning of the season as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It took that long for it to find its footing.
He had to stop trying to be Seth MacFarlane from Family Guy and become the Seth MacFarlane that backed the new Cosmos.
Yeah, yeah. And he's kind of the good guy to do it because he actually, like Star Trek, apparently, from what I read and heard, is that he's a big fan of the Star Trek stuff. So anyway.
Yeah, sorry.
But Brian Talbot's another one. I like Talbot.
I thought Talbot was a good mix. I started with Sandman on the last issue of Season of Mists, which I think had Dringenberg coming back for an issue or something. Maybe not.
Yeah.
And then immediately after that,
they did Dringenberg Dinks.
Yeah. Then they did the Distant Windows the series of short stories, and Talbot did August, and I really enjoyed that story. And I'd never been a big Talbot guy, but he was so good on that one particular story. He did a few more afterwards, as I recall, and I tended to enjoy the combination of those two creators.
He did the Orpheus story, no?
The Sandman special. That sounds right.
Yeah,
with the glow-in-the-dark cover.
Yeah.
Yeah, well considered that. I've never failed to look at a Dave McKeon painting and think that what it really needed was an enhancement of some kind, some gimmicky foil prismatic image or something.
Absolutely. That gallery show would really pop. Well, what should we do? It's 1:30. Should we call it a night?
I've had a blast. This has been awesome. I definitely want to do this again.
It's been fun.
Yeah. Hey, is there anything in particular upcoming that you wanted to talk about?
I think you've probably got the measure of me. Aliens wise, I sent you a screenshot of the other stuff that I've read and love, like the Corbin stuff, the sure. Davis, Alien Salvation, which you've covered already, right?
I haven't done Salvation. I think that it was which is the one that Mike Mignola did.
Yeah, exactly, Salvation. Yeah.
Okay, that one. Odell Abner Dracula wanted to do a single Aliens, and that was the one. That's his. I've been waiting to get to him on that one, but I couldn't remember what was the one that was painted artwork that I think it came
Sacrifice.
Out of
Sacrifice.
Sacrifice.
James Robinson.
Yeah.
And
Paul Johnson.
James Robinson. Paul Johnson. Yeah.
Yeah. So because the names are so similar, I was making sure. Okay, which one are you talking about? Because I've Odell may end up completely flaking out on me, in which case there'd be a course correction. But so far, yeah. I've had that saved for him, waiting for us to get to that point.
Yeah, they collected those two together at some point.
Makes sense.
I think.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, it's Guy Davis, Richard Corbin. That's a great one.
Mm-hmm.
Havoc, the two-part.
Oh, yeah, that's a ways out, though. I think that's like 98 or so. So I don't think that's coming up anytime soon. So
that's Final Throws, right?
Yeah. Well, not necessarily. They had that comeback in the around 2010. I'm not ruling out the Marvel stuff either, but it's like, given my track record with podcasts, I'm not making any grand pronouncements about how long this is going to go on. We'll see what happens. But outside of the alien stuff, is there anything else of interest?
There's various image books. I'm trying to think. I don't know. There's a good deal of crossovers that I quite like. Like Batman Deathblow. You've done Batman Predator already. But Green Lantern Aliens. I think you said there's already somebody in the frame for that. Just reach out. Drop me a line, and if I think of anything, I know where to find you. I can drop you a line and ask if there's anything on your radar. Nothing leaks out of me.
No worries. Like I said, this was a blast. As long as you had fun, then I'm definitely going to hit you up again because it's been awesome.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. I still need to do something with Shadowhawk too. I'm not going to make you read anything. Don't feel like you got to read anything. But if you want to do a conversation
read it for free, I'm fine.
What's that?
As long as I can read it for free, I'm fine.
Right, right.
If I can find it online scroll through.
Well, some of these, what I'm doing is just like doing sort of an overview of the character and then interspersing me doing this happened, and then having somebody else talk about, oh, I like the idea of this character and I like what this guy did. I would probably call you in for like an overview. And so you could probably pull that out of your boo-boo as opposed to having to actually do any research on that stuff.
Most of that image stuff up until, I'd say most of that image stuff, I've got some opinion on. There's like, I feel a little bit like Chance Wolfe never got his due when you think of the amount of extreme people that went on to do stuff. I don't know what Chance Wolfe did, but
he's Jim Valentino's inker of choice, and there's still Valentine, what little of that ever got produced.
But he, he seems like a reasonably credible talent in comparison to a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
The Wildstorm stuff is probably my main image focus, but even then, like, Backlash, piece of shit. like, fucking dreadful.
But the fact that you've read it and have an opinion, that's my main thing, because that's one thing it's been a stumbling point, is I tried to get fixed on as much of this as possible, but I misremembered him buying more Image stuff back in the comic shop days than he must have actually done, or he must have been very specific about what he did pick up, because there's a lot of stuff he just does not have much thought or opinion on, and so it's just like, if I just have a color guy for some of this stuff, that would be ideal. So even if you're like, boy, Brett Booth, what a piece of shit, you know, I mean, I personally like Brett Booth personally, but I don't remember Backlash being a particularly good comic. That I didn't read it, I only skimmed it ever, so I don't really have strong opinions myself until I go back and actually read his stuff. So I know your sphere is Wildstorm, then since a lot of that Wildstorm stuff is going to be intentionally one episode, just a quick overview, you'd probably be perfect for that, and you wouldn't have to do any research for it.
I recommended the show to a friend, and he was like, it's just a guy who knows a ton of stuff talking to his mate who doesn't seem to know anything. And I was like, yeah, but they're not all like that. But with a podcast, once you've listened to like 2 hours, it's like, no, listen to the next one. You know, it's a bit difficult as a sell, but...
I try not to let it go there, but sometimes that's what it ends up being. It's true.
Anyway, I also really enjoyed the I've not gone too far into all of the other shows.
Hey, listen, I'm lucky you listen to the ones you do listen to. Don't worry about the other stuff.
I listen to your stuff pretty consistently. The other one that I really enjoyed was the Who's Editing, which I know you're on a couple of, but that's a good fun nerdy conceit. Like, I don't even have a frame of reference for a lot of what's being talked about there, but I really enjoy that show.
Well, what's great about it is, since it's all concept pitches anyway, you don't have to have a background. It's like, is that a cool idea? Does that sound like a book I'd want to read? So I think it's very new listener friendly. Without, it's basically the opposite of Who's Who when you think about it, because if you don't have a frame of reference for those characters, having somebody drone on about what a great job, you know, Joe Orlando did on that House of Mystery entry is like, what? You know, it's meaningless to you. Where if you have an interest in comics and stories, it's pretty accessible.
Yeah, you know, it's really good. Are there any others that I'm missing? It's like, because it feels like a lot of it is very DC or like Shazam or like very centered on a specific thing. Whereas Who's Editing and your show don't seem to have that same.
I'm not a fan. Like, one thing that drives me nuts, I don't like the indexing shows. I can't fathom spending 45 minutes, an hour, 90 minutes talking about a issue of a comic book. That's the type of podcasting I try to do that in my early days, and I don't enjoy doing it. I don't enjoy listening to it. I need at least a little bit of perspective. Give me 4 issues, you know, give me an arc, give me a miniseries, something like that. We've started and let pod fade tons of stuff, but, you know, you just throw shit at the wall and see what sticks, and, you know, what you continue to have an interest in talking about, what the other person wants to do, you know. So it's I do whatever I can where the muse strikes, and if people like it, they like it, if they don't, it's like like in the early days of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I used to try to listen to every single one of their shows, and then, like, since and just the limitations of a human being and attention span and towers and stuff come in. So these days, given how many good quality podcasts there are being made by professionals with proper production and research teams and shit, I always feel blessed if anybody listens to any of the bullshit we put out there. So if what you dig is aliens and Spawn Armor, please, hopefully we continue to do stuff that'll hold your interest, but probably being on some of the shows won't hurt either.
The trouble with some of the I listened to the Wonder Woman one, which was great, like, with only relative, like, quite minimal interest in Wonder Woman. Like, if you couldn't get Superman back issues, you definitely couldn't get Wonder Woman
right issues. Right, well, and honestly, you wouldn't want them. There's so many bad Wonder Woman comic books that, you know, I wouldn't wish some of that stuff on people.
What do you think? I keep bubbling up in the conversation. What about Matt Wagner's Trinity? Did you enjoy that?
I never read it. I bought it new, and it's been sitting in my long boxes the entire freaking time.
That feels like you got to read that.
Yeah. The good thing about that is it's self-contained, so I could do that relatively easily. I may take the reader's suggestion, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's like Wagner, who I think probably second only or maybe first only to Greg Rucka as like blokes who can do a decent, strong female character.
Mm-hmm.
I think between Wagner and Wonder Woman, it feels like it should be high on your list. But anyway, the other thing I was going to say is I love your dad's great, but it took me a while to realize that it was your dad. So some context.
Right.
Coming to an episode cold and then just suddenly getting you talking to this cool fella with a very specific point of reference,
mm-hmm.
might benefit from here's my dad.
Well, in the earlier, like I think some of the more recent ones, it's more of a cold start. But with the earlier ones, we did say, hey, look, it's the father and son spies podcast. So it's like, okay, we're a little more open. That's one where there's a little bit of continuity. But also, as is clear from any episode, there's also clearly no continuity at the same time. So these things sort of happen and go to places that I cannot anticipate.
No, it's great hearing your dad say, I find it interesting that you're clearly, you're very, what's the word? You're very aware of the current politic, and yet you can't help but say chicks.
Right. Yeah. Well,
bring your dad in, and it sort of takes it up another level.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's the awareness, and then there's the adherence. And I have awareness, but I don't always have adherence. I know what the speed limit is, but that doesn't mean I necessarily abide by it. So yeah, I guess it makes it more wrong in a way. It's like my father is wrong because he just doesn't know better because he's a dinosaur.
It's my dad's claim. It's fine. Yeah.
And me, I'm wrong sometimes just as a matter of choice and unfortunately bad judgment calls sometimes. I put out that one from 2016 recently where I was just like ripping Tara Reid to shreds needlessly. Poor thing. So it's like, I've definitely come a long ways from that at least. But yeah, still not the most enlightened person despite here we would call it virtue signaling, but it's like, yeah, I try, but sometimes I fail quite miserably.
There's a podcast I listen to called, I can't remember, it will come to me, it doesn't matter. There's a podcast about films and which films you take with you to, it's like a desert island type thing.
Yeah.
And the host is constantly, the host is a guy called Brett, something or other, who's in the that Apple TV show about the football team in the UK.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know Ted Lasso is what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, Ted Lasso.
I didn't watch it, but my girlfriend did, so.
It's good, but the guy who's the captain, Brett Goldstein, is the host of this show, and he's constant. Everything, he feels the need to talk about everything is problematic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, well, of course, it's problematic that it's a little girl who goes into the sea to rescue the shark, but the shark, oh, of course, it's problematic that it's the wife who comes, oh, of course, it's problematic. It's like, you don't need to keep apologizing for 30-year-old films. Right. And just acknowledge it. It's a good film.
Right, yeah.
It drives me at the fucking wall.
I try not to be that guy. I'm sure I am sometimes, but I try not to be. Yeah, I try to find a balance. Moments. Yeah.
You know that if it's going out into the world, there's a chance that someone's going to pick it up and misconstrue what you're saying. So you have to foreshadow that.
Mm-hmm.
But
shit that was okay at one time that isn't okay anymore. And there are things that we knew better even then, and things that we just like literally were completely blind to. So I think it's one thing to acknowledge it, but like you said, don't be like, well, we'll put the trigger warning on everything. That's kind of ridiculous. let's be grown-ups about it too.
Yeah, I'll share one last thing. Is that before I'll share with you, if you didn't see it, there was an Alan Moore Frank Miller Daredevil parody. Did you see that last few days on Twitter?
Oh no, definitely not then. No.
Okay, I'll share that. It's like three pages from an old British magazine, and it's Frank Miller, it's Alan Moore and Mike Collins and Mark Farmer doing like a bang-on parody of Miller's Daredevil with like the city with its smoke, the city with its smoke, and black men with stereos on their shoulders and woolly hats. You know, it's kind of like, oh my. And what I found really interesting was, like, you could read Frank Miller Daredevil now and go, oh, that all seems a little bit dated. But the idea that Alan Moore is someone who's smart enough that at the time was reading it and going, that's not going to age well.
Yeah.
Alan Moore is cleverer than us. Fact. All right.
But listen, it's a pleasure to finally meet you, finally talk with you. I've had a blast and definitely want to do it again.
Cool beans. All right. You take it easy. Speak soon. Good night.
Dr. ANJ, Billy Hines, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, Dear Watchers is now on Threads, Ed Moore, Eugene R. Hendrix, GFX Christine 00, Gregory Litchfield, Derek WC, Iowa's Joe is, Irredeemable Shag, Julia Raul, who added, I am seriously excited about Frank eventually talking about Terminator comics, Kailash Jwalamukhi writer and Maedya in charge, Keith G. Baker, King Dinosaur, Martin Ray, Maxo, Mike's Favorite Holiday, Randy Caldwell, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Resurrections, A Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Scott X, Speaker of the House, Kirk Spencer, Superbound, and Talk Nerdy to Me.
That was Dead Air.